be seated. Thank you. Good morning. Before we get started with our first case this morning, everyone's well aware we had national and state elections last night, and Justice Scott Myron was on the ballot for retention, and congratulations to him on being retained by 80%. We're really pleased with the result and the confidence of the voters of South Dakota and Justice Myron in the court system. So congratulations. With that, our first case this morning is CalSD versus InterWest Leasing. John Burke is present, will be arguing on behalf of InterWest Leasing, and Robert Galbraith is present, will be arguing on behalf of CalSD. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Burke, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Honorable Chief Justice Jensen, members of the court, Mr. Galbraith, I represent the appellant today, InterWest Leasing, LLC. Again, it's my honor to be before the court to be able to argue today. In short, I'm going to ask you respectfully to reverse the circuit court. The record is clear that the circuit court submitted this case to a jury for a binding verdict, not an advisory jury. And it's equally clear that in any case, even under the context of an advisory jury, the circuit court did not follow the procedures or protocols as laid out in detail in Granite Buick GMC in terms of what you do with an advisory jury. As a result, as we stand here today, absent consent, which is not being argued, reversal is necessary unless this court concludes one thing. This court would have to come to the conclusion that CalSD's claim was at law as opposed to equitable in nature, and therefore entitling CalSD to a jury trial as a matter of right. Briefly, I want to touch upon this case, in my mind, triggers two different standards of review. I think in terms of classifying the nature of the cause of action, at law versus equity, I think that is a question of law that this court would review de novo. But in terms of impaneling an advisory jury, I think that that falls under an abuse of discretion standard. However, this court has been clear that by definition, a decision based upon an error of law is de facto an abuse of discretion. Very briefly also, before I get into why there's not a claim at law in this case, is I think there's a typical belief that everybody has a right to a jury trial. Under Article 6, Section 6 of our Constitution, there's a guarantee a right to a jury trial in all cases at law. Now, notwithstanding that, statutorily in 15-6-39C, a circuit court has the discretion to impanel an advisory jury to address an equitable claim. However, absent consent, it's advisory only. The case that frankly is most influential is the Granite Buick GMC Inc. case versus Ray. So what we'd like to talk about in large part today are really just two issues. One.
So before you get into the merits, there was an argument from CalSD that there wasn't adequate preservation of error in this case in terms of, you know, as I understand it, the jury instructions were submitted by stipulation. And so I'd like to have you respond to the argument that there isn't preservation here.
No, I appreciate that, Your Honor. This was an interesting case, and frankly, it's in the record, but if the court gets a chance to look at it, the issue was raised at the pretrial conference. I expressed concern about why would we be having a jury trial. There was argument by opposing counsel, and the circuit court square on said, I think we have a legal issue on breach. After, and I'm coming to the Chief Justice's question, after the pretrial conference, the circuit court sent out an email where he referred to the conundrum that I raised and then went a little bit different path and said, at the end of the day, the circuit court felt that the legal question remaining is whether Cal breached the agreement, thus entitling InterWest to damages. And at that point, so this is after the pretrial conference, we're 4 weeks from trial, 3 weeks from trial or so, the circuit court is looking at switching the role of the parties from plaintiff to defendant. So it was going to make defendant InterWest Leasing become the plaintiff. I briefed that, and it stayed the way we have it today. So then we get back to the Chief Justice's question. Once the circuit court determines that we are proceeding as an action at law, it seems to InterWest Leasing that we don't want to inject error into that case. At that point, the court has made it clear that we're trying a question of law, okay? And the court is saying we're trying to breach a contract claim. So at that point, I think when the circuit court picks the path that counsel are on, it seems to me that, okay, I'm in this environment now. I'm going to try my best with what's presented. And so we talked about things, as counsel has raised. The burden of proof was greater convincing force. The jury instructions focused on breach of contract and things like that. And the Chief Justice is correct that ultimately the instructions that were settled, I think the final set, after doing some discussions off the record and making some brief objections, both counsel found workable, and we proceeded in that fashion.
But you didn't submit any instructions, like proposals, that would suggest, hey, court, you need to instruct the jury. This is equitable, and it's not a binding verdict, or the burden of proof is different. You didn't instruct any proposals like that?
That's correct, because I think when the court takes us down the path of at law, I feel like I would almost be injecting error if I went into an at law context and said, okay, jury, we're going to do a couple different things here with you. We're going to get into a legal question about breach, which is where the court said the issue was, and then I'm injecting, I guess in theory, a burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence, which to me would be internally inconsistent. And then also I think, and we allude to this in our brief, you get to arguments about unclean hands, equitable estoppel, which I don't know that it would be a good idea for InterWest Leasing to inject error into what the court has determined as an at-law case. And so I think where InterWest found itself is, okay, the court has said we're going down this road. I made my record and said immediately again before the trial, I feel like we're in a situation here where they're effectively trying to rescind the contract. I don't think we should be having a jury trial. The court disagreed. And so I feel once you're in that arena, you have to go with what the court, the path that the circuit court is taking. If I get back to the first issue, whether it's a claim at law versus at equity, this court has looked at a few things, frankly. But if you look at Granite Buick and some of the earlier cases, First National Bank of Philip versus Temple and Nizluski, if I'm saying it incorrectly, they really look at just three things in large part. They try to get to what is the subject of the cause of action. This court also looks at the complaint, the pleadings, the prayer for relief. And then in that First National Bank case, it said, you know, we look at the ultimate and entire relief sought. And what we've submitted here, Your Honor, is if you step back, I'm sorry, members of the court, but if you step back and look at what the core of this case is about, and it gets into one of the disagreements we have with CalSD, is this party's relationship arose from a contractual setting. And so you should look back to the contract to determine, okay, what are we fighting about here? The relief that CalSD wanted was based upon a provision that dealt with what entitles you to the return of your earnest money. And if you look at the language, it talks about if they are unable to secure financing, the agreement is void. It's void. And so I would submit, members of the court, that what CalSD was trying to do, if you step back at its overall relief, is it needs to have this contract rescinded or declared void.
It says more than that. It just doesn't say that it's void. It imposes, in the very next phrase, a contractual obligation upon the seller to refund the purchaser's earnest money. So it's not just that we have to kind of figure out what kind of floaty thing void might mean, or cancel or rescind or whatever. It's right there. It says it's void, and purchaser's earnest money shall be returned in full, less expenses. So that's the contract. What else is there?
Because the relief that they seek to get that remedy under the contract, and many types of equitable relief, Your Honor, come from the form of a contract. People will seek specific performance based upon a breach or things like that. But to have the entitlement to get it returned, and the relief that they sought, if you look at their prayer for relief, the nature of the declaratory judgment action, is they use the word canceled. But they're coming to the court in a declaration saying, we would like this thing unwound, canceled, declared void, however you want to phrase it, and tell a third party, because we have to keep in mind that we weren't sued for $30,000. There was not, and the judgment did not award money damages. The judgment simply said that party is entitled to relief, much like an equitable order would, and it ordered a third party, because the title company was holding the funds, to release the money to them. And so the
But you wouldn't consent to the release.
We circulated a cancellation. They didn't agree with it. The parties did not agree on where it should end up. Yes, Your Honor.
Understand that, but that kind of leaks into the good faith argument. We had a trial on that, and the trial, warts and all in your view perhaps, yielded what it yielded. So we're back to the idea, aren't we, that if the contingency for financing hasn't been satisfied, the contract tells the parties exactly what their rights and their obligations are.
Yes, and they came to court to have a court confirm that it was void. And ultimately, and I'm not meaning to quibble.
Let me take a little bit of issue with that. Weren't they really asking the court to determine whether or not they had in good faith been unable to obtain financing? That was really the question before the jury, wasn't it? And the ultimate relief was, we want to enforce the provision of the contract. In other words, this wasn't like Granite Buick, where they were attempting to obtain equitable relief in the form of an injunction. The contract's already void if they prove that they were unable in good faith to obtain financing. Isn't that true?
The difference I have, and I might have misunderstood the last one, are you saying they've already proven that they were unable to secure financing?
I'm saying the contract's already canceled, rescinded, void, whatever you want to call it, if they prove they were unable to get financing.
Respectfully, I would disagree for this reason, because the scope is broader. If they're seeking equitable relief, the scope's going to be broader in a couple respects. Their burden to the trier of fact, in this case it ended up being a binding jury, would have been different than to a court. We could have argued they have a high burden to show. I mean, we know the jury struggled with it. They were out, I think, maybe 3.5 hours or something like that. They had a question about, you know, what do we do if we can't agree? But I don't know, aside from the burden of proof, we don't get the benefit of bringing into, and it circles back to Justice Salter's question, the scope of that trial by being forced solely on the legal question of almost was there a breach by not trying to get financing deprived us of the broader scope of what are we talking about when we get into unclean hands. There's respectfully, and it delves deep into the record in terms of the conduct of CalSD and Ms. Roberts as the sort of interim manager of it. But if we can argue evidence in front of the circuit court about unclean hands, the jury sees more things that might bother it and also be putting CalSD to a higher burden of proof. So if the court presented it like it did, which was as a legal question, a breach of contract, then in that sense, our scope is narrower because we were purely looking at was there, more likely than not, an effort to secure financing, you know? And we struggle with that because the burden of proof is different and the scope of the evidence is different. I do appreciate the question that you know, the parties could disagree as to whether to return the money and could they have sued us for breach of contract. I don't quite agree with that in the sense that if you look at what entitles them to that relief, it uses the term void. And I understand that we may not agree with it, but the fact that we disagree or whether they might call that a breach by not agreeing with them doesn't change that the ultimate remedy they needed, because I think under most of the case law, void and rescission take you to the same place. In other words, they unwind the deal and put you back in the shoes that you were before you entered into this contract.
But why would equity have to intervene in order to affect that if the contract under its plain provisions already contemplates that?
Well, I guess if the parties disagree and you have the money in the hands of a third party, Your Honor, Someone, there has to be a ruling that resolves the party's disagreement, and I'm saying in this sense, for them to get there, they needed that contract to be void, which is an equitable remedy.
Or you agree and capitulate based upon, which I'm not saying you have to do, but or you agree and capitulate based upon the language of the contract. This says it's void. That element seems, if not self-executing, pretty far down the road in terms of where the parties are and what the state of the contract is. And then it says there's an obligation to return the money.
Agreed. And I would submit, Your Honor, that a host of equitable claims come out of a contractual setting where parties have contractual obligations. But the existence of that contractual obligation, as in Granite Buick, it was an employment agreement, doesn't change that the remedy or the relief is in the nature of something that's equitable. The other thing, if I could touch upon it very briefly with my remaining 15 seconds, is there's no question that the court did not comply with Granite Buick. It wasn't intending to impanel an advisory jury. And in terms of adopting the decision or setting it aside or doing findings or advising of any intent to use an advisory jury, none of that happened, and that's not disputed. Thank you.
Mr. Galbraith, you can proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Berg. The issues that were tried in this case were whether or not there was a breach of the purchase agreement. The parties agreed as we went through the process that the issues that were being tried in the case were whether or not there was a breach of the purchase agreement. Now, as we worked through the pretrial issues, as we worked through what type of...
The question of whether there was a breach by CalSD.
Correct.
Right? I mean, that was really the only question was, did you breach the contract? Did you not in good faith obtain financing?
And that the question ultimately ended up being to the jury whether or not you made good faith efforts to secure financing as a requirement in the contract. And really even what I had proposed as we were leading into that trial was a more general term of whether there was breach.
Which was a pretty significant issue because there was a real question, was this about financing or just, you know, the owner died and no longer wanted to go that direction. And, you know, so it was a significant question for a fact for the jury. And, of course, they resolved it in your favor.
But very much so, Justice Jensen. And the pretrial motions in this case, at one point in time, Judge Feifley looked at the parties and said, we've had enough. We're not going to file any more pretrial motions. We had three motions for summary judgment. There was a request to file another one after the motions deadline had passed. We had done, I think, a couple different pretrial conference checklists. And really what created some uniqueness and some difficulty in this case is when these earnest money deposits are put with title companies. Because I can't sue a party for breach for failing to remit the earnest money to me because they don't have it. The title company has it, and the title company has told both parties, we're not handing this out unless you guys agree or there's an order of the court. And so we file a deck action with the court to say we need the court to declare the status of this, and ultimately we work through whether or not there's a breach. There were motions for summary judgment where I, on behalf of my client, argued we don't think the earnest money provision in this case is valid. We think it's a penalty under South Dakota law. It's not liquidated damages. Judge Feifley denied that motion. There was a cross motion that said, we think the earnest money provision is liquidated damages. Everything leading up to the trial was related to the fact that the earnest money was liquidated damages, and so that's why we didn't have presentation of damage testimony, because we knew there weren't any. And it's why we can't go through rescission cancellation. Because if we turn around now and we go back into the shoes of we're sitting pretrial, and the issue now is rescission or cancellation, which was never tried and never even suggested to be tried, if my client doesn't prove rescission or cancellation, we're back in the same spot that we were in before. Because we never asked the court beyond the suggestion in the initial complaint that we have to determine whether there was a cancellation or lack thereof or entitlement to the earnest money. all of those things were put at issue. And as we all know in these cases, we have to start broad and we narrow down to the issues that are ultimately going to be tried. Because there were messages throughout the course of this, and those were exhibits at trial on the addendums and the cancellation that was provided. And absolutely, as to Justice Salter's question, the cancellation that was provided by InterWest Leasing said, I, InterWest Leasing, retain all of the earnest money. And my client said, no, we don't agree with that. We believe that we didn't breach the contract, and so we get the earnest money back.
So whether you call it breach or compliance or noncompliance or whatever, that's the next step, right? If the good faith issue is resolved in CalSD's favor, then it seems like the contract would suggest the failure to comply with the shall return the earnest money is whatever, noncompliance, nonconformity, whatever it is, breach, whatever. But it's not doing what the contract says the order of operations ought to be.
Correct. And that ultimately where I started broader and said that the jury should simply determine, did CalSD breach, yes or no? The court ultimately narrowed that down based on the pretrial rulings, based on summary judgment, where really the only allegation that was being tried, the only contingency in the contract that would mean that CalSD did not breach was the financing contingency. Whether the purchaser can obtain financing on terms and conditions to enable purchaser at purchaser's discretion to purchase the property. That's what the jury got to hear. Was the purchaser able to obtain financing on the terms and conditions that the purchaser would at their discretion be able to purchase the property? That's in section 4 of the commercial real estate purchase agreement. And then that ties back into section 13, which we've focused a lot on, and that's the earnest money provision, which says it shall be returned. But again, if I sue as CalSD, if I sue InterWest Leasing and say, you have to return this earnest money, or you need to pay me this earnest money, InterWest Leasing says, I don't have it. And so we get stuck in this, the title, and that's why the judgment said what the judgment said, is the parties ultimately said, okay, the title company has the earnest money. And the parties fought about whether or not that earnest money was liquidated damages or what it was. And the trial court ultimately determined if CalSD breached, notwithstanding that CalSD argued InterWest Leasing had no damages, that was a liquidated damage provision. And if CalSD breached the contract, then InterWest Leasing was going to be entitled to the earnest money. And under the language that Justice Salter pointed out, if CalSD didn't breach the contract, then they shall be entitled to the return of the earnest money. And so the fact that there's no quote-unquote damages in the judgment, that doesn't mean that this case wasn't about breach of contract. It simply means we all knew that the title company was holding the alleged damages, what InterWest Leasing asked the court to declare was InterWest Leasing's liquidated damages if they could prove that CalSD breached, and so we needed an order to go to the title company to say you need to remit this here or there on based on whether or not there was a breach.
So fair to say, your view was we didn't breach the contract, we couldn't obtain financing, we're simply enforcing the provision that says the agreement's void, we're entitled to get our earnest money back.
Correct, and that's the case that was presented to the jury. The jury ultimately had instructions specifically on what a buyer's obligation is to obtain financing, and they had to determine whether or not CalSD satisfied the necessary requirements to obtain financing and could not get it. And the jury ultimately found that CalSD didn't breach, that CalSD did make good faith efforts such that it believed it was necessary or appropriate to obtain financing, and that the earnest money, the liquidated damages, weren't damages to InterWest Leasing, but should be returned to CalSD.
Yeah, it actually, I don't think it's a fine point. I don't think it really matters a whole lot. But the purchase agreement doesn't say, it seems to contemplate that the seller won't have the money in his possession, because it says the earnest money shall be returned. It doesn't say the seller shall return the money. It says the money shall be returned. Probably a passive voice, maybe it was inartful, but maybe not. Maybe that's exactly what it meant. This is the state of the party's relative rights and obligations if we reach this point of voidness.
Correct. But if CalSD sues InterWest Leasing for $30,000, and then let's go say CalSD gets a judgment against InterWest Leasing for $30,000 for failing to retain the earnest money, we may end up in a situation where InterWest Leasing has to pay $30,000 or, heaven forbid, can't pay $30,000, and we still don't have a resolution of the issues for the title company that to this day, as I stand here now, still holds this money, even with the judgment that was entered by Judge Feifley, because they know that the appeal exists and the title company wants to make sure that everything is exhausted so they don't expose themselves to liability. It is the only issue that was tried. As Mr. Burke was asked right at the beginning in the issue on preservation of error, you know, there's really two issues to talk about with preservation of error, because they're both is the request for a jury trial or a court trial. And that really, I mean, I don't think there was any disagreement in the briefing leading up to the very last pretrial conference. There was no question amongst everybody that this was a jury trial. And we've put citations to transcripts in there. The first time Judge Feifley asked, and this is a jury trial, right? InterWest counsel said, yes, both parties have asked for a jury trial. The inquiry at the pretrial conference on November 16th of 2023, several weeks before trial, Judge Feifley again asked the parties, he said, yeah, my understanding as we sit here today, gentlemen, the only factual question we're asking our jury to determine was whether or not there's a breach. And I agreed based on breach of contract. Mr. Burke said, we are, Your Honor, except in my proposed instructions, I tailored the issue more narrowly to, because I thought it was cleaner for the jury, but I didn't. I'd like to come back to that, but you want me to stay on track with the motions in limine. When he came back to it, he said at the end, In dealing with a housekeeping issue, I wondered, because I thought that this should be the time, given that the sole count remaining is a deck action, I wondered would it not be prudent, if they're saying no jury instructions are appropriate, that we're not having a court trial. He didn't say my client objects to a jury trial or demands a court trial or this should be cancellation or this should be rescission. He said, I wonder. Now, at the start of trial, morning of trial, absolutely, before we get started, the formal objection is made to having a jury trial, and Judge Feifley, we're sitting with a jury impaneled sitting in the other room, overrules that. But there's two questions. The first question is whether the jury trial was demanded or there was some agreement to try it to a jury. But then there's the question of what did we actually try to the jury? They're now arguing that it should have been rescission, cancellation, but it wasn't. The parties agreed, and nowhere in the record until the appeal was there a suggestion that we were trying anything other than whether or not my client breached the contract. And ultimately, there's no objections to the jury instructions. There's no objections to instruction 23, which was condition precedent, which basically told the jury, if there's a condition precedent, a term that needs to be met before a party has an obligation to fulfill its duties, if there's something that relieves CalSD of its obligation to close, then there's no breach of contract. Well, the jury sat and determined that there was a condition precedent, the financing provision, and that CalSD did not breach the contract. Until we got to the appeal, no one ever suggested that we're trying cancellation or should have tried cancellation or rescission. What we tried was the breach of contract. So as we look to where we ultimately ended up, the parties go in, the parties litigate, cross motions, tens of thousands of dollars on whether or not the earnest money are liquidated damages. Why are we fighting over liquidated damages if we're not fighting over breach of contract? And ultimately, that was InterWest Leasing's request, to determine that the earnest money was liquidated damages. Judge Feifley agreed with InterWest Leasing. Judge Feifley entered an order that said, the court, having examined all the pleadings, files, and records herein, and having heard and considered the arguments of counsel, concludes that as a matter of law, the earnest money provision in the commercial real estate purchase agreement is a validated liquidated damages clause. If we're trying rescission, we're not talking about liquidated damages. We're just talking about rescission or cancellation of a contract. That's not what was tried to the court. That's not what anybody suggested should be tried to the court. Even so, and even if it had been suggested and Judge Feifley overruled it, what we tried absolutely was whether or not CalSD breached the contract, whether or not CalSD took the appropriate actions to try and obtain financing, or in this case really was precluded as a result of any number of facts, many of which are in both parties' brief, none of which are really important to the appeal. The appeal here is not a factual issue. It's a legal issue to this court as far as whether or not we tried an equitable remedy or a remedy at law. But everything that went to this jury was to try whether or not there were good faith efforts to obtain financing, or if CalSD didn't do that, that they breached the contract and InterWest Leasing would have received liquidated damages. The jury heard all of that. The jury heard all of the evidence that's been suggested in the briefing. Oh, we could have produced this or that on unclean hands. All of the evidence that was suggested in the briefing that went to that came from citations to the trial transcript. The jury heard all of the evidence. Judge Feifley heard all of the evidence, even if we ended up on some remand and could issue findings of fact and conclusions of law related to that. But the jury heard all of the evidence. They determined CalSD didn't breach the contract. And as a result of that and Judge Feifley's prior decision on liquidated damages, he ordered that those earnest monies be returned to CalSD. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Burke, you can proceed with rebuttal. And before you get started, let me just ask you, so wasn't this lawsuit really about who gets the 30 grand? Does it go back to CalSD or does it stay with InterWest because CalSD didn't obtain financing or breached the contract by under the financing clause? Because you're in a position where if the contract's not already canceled or void, you've just sold the property to two people.
Yes, Your Honor. That was the fight. And that argument was raised by the appellee, and I thought it was interesting because absent them seeking this declaration, they failed to close. They never showed up for closing. They were in breach. So that was the end of that, and we had the right to sell it to someone else. I know that argument was made by the appellee, but I disagree with that. I do want to follow up on a couple of comments, and I can't remember the justice that asked the question, but counsel's response was, well, we can't sue a party for a breach. If that's the case, that's making my point. They have argued that they could not sue us for breach of contract. If that's the case, then that seems to reinforce the notion that they're seeking equitable relief. And counsel agreed or argued again today, we can't sue these folks for breach. And honestly, if you want to view it, if CalSD tried to sue us in breach of contract, they would almost be suing us to have a jury determine that they didn't breach the contract. That's how ill-fitting that is, in my mind, to an action at law. I disagree with the suggestion that all parties up until the final pretrial conference were like unanimously talking about a jury trial on this debt claim. That's simply not the case. InterWest Leasing did not demand a jury trial in response to the complaint. The only jury trial that was ever brought up by InterWest Leasing in a pleading was in a third-party complaint against Ms. Roberts. The circuit court granted summary judgment on that. And I'm a little bit, I'm not entirely sure how to respond to it, but I feel that I must have to. The argument seems to be a little bit, although it wasn't raised in the appellee's brief as a binding consent under 15639C, the argument's creeping that way as we stand here today. And I would submit that was not directly argued in the brief. In fact, I don't think consent's even in their brief, and I know that they did not cite 15639C, but the argument seems stronger today that happened. And that is not the case, and there wasn't consent. And the issue was raised to the circuit court. And like I alluded to before, even after the pretrial conference, the circuit court is grappling with what the issue that we're all wrestling with today. The circuit court was struggling with how to deal with what it saw as an action of law and how to get that in front of a jury. And I think the struggle that led it to consider flipping the parties was the notion that it seemed odd in the circuit court's mind for CalSD to be suing us for breach of contract only to prove that they didn't breach, which is counterintuitive. But we ended up making the argument and objecting, and as this court referred to, I think it was in a state of tank. I mean, the goal here is to give the circuit court an opportunity to correct the path or remedy the error, and that was done here. We got the circuit court back on the right path in terms of who should be the plaintiff, but we didn't get much farther. And to give this court an idea, I know it looks at the pleadings and the prayer for relief, but if you go back to the early pretrial conference checklist, the initial round, you'll see that even CalSD and Ms. Roberts' pretrial conference checklist, the appellee said, CalSD believes that the issues between CalSD and InterWest Leasing involve legal determinations or declarations by the court, and as such, no jury instructions are necessary or appropriate. That's CalSD's position in its initial pretrial conference. And then, much as the case is doing today, it kind of moved. And I will say, it was in advance of the trial, and I specifically said before the jury trial again to raise the issue again, this is in the nature of an equitable action, sort of like to rescind the contract or have it void. So I'm saying what I'm trying to convey to the court. And to be clear, the prejudice would not have been tough. At best, it would have been to tell 50 people in the veneer they could go home at 8:15 in the morning. So we could have righted the ship right then. The last thing I wanted to talk about, because I think it's important, is that simply remanding for findings and conclusions won't remedy the error. Okay? And I know that that's the typical practice, but I don't think that will suffice here, because the problem we have is the record and the evidence that we put before the trier of fact dealt with this narrower scope of, was there an effort to provide financing? But if we can talk about things like unclean hands and equitable estoppel, Ms. Roberts' conduct, things like running other businesses as the manager for CalSD while saying she had no authority in our case, those sorts of things become relevant in a hurry. That evidence comes in when you can talk about unclean hands. It doesn't come in an action at law over an alleged breach of contract for failure to secure financing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.